You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 362, Revelation 3, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Well, my Packers, of course, got eliminated. So that's what's going on, Trey. So I need to do biblical stuff to take my mind off that terrible loss.
Yeah, no, I don't. That's a good distraction for one. And when this podcast comes out, Mike, it's actually Super Bowl weekend. So for those that are listening to this episode, I hope you're watching my homie warm up, and it's going to be a good Super Bowl, Mike. The good thing is we did a lot of our sports talking before I hit record, so
that's one good thing
for y'all.
It's out of my system.
Yeah. I had to hear my
I've
cry.
Adequately vented.
He literally cried, boo-hooed out loud. Right. I had to calm him down so we could do this episode.
Man.
So, yeah.
I feel just terrible. Pain. Here, I wanted to wear my Packers shirt, you know, while we did the podcast and be all ready for kickoff, but nope.
Well, that's all right.
I'm done now. I'm not gonna drag it out, inflict any more pain.
Hopefully Rodgers will be a Packer next year.
Yeah, thanks for that, Trey.
Oh, my bad. I didn't mean to bring that up.
You want to go there.
Too soon? Okay.
Too soon.
Too soon? Okay. Well, might as well just switch gears. We're going to have two parts of Revelation 3 here, huh?
Yep. This will be part one today. I might as well just, you know, telegraph what we're going to do. So in this episode, we're going to hit everything in Revelation 3 that's Old Testament pertinent that we haven't hit before. You know, there is, you know, in these letters, there's been overlap of content. This will be no different. But I'm going to skip the keys of David in Revelation 3:7. And that's what's going to be part two, because we're going to take that verse and then loop back to Revelation 1:18, the keys of death and Hades, and devote a full episode to this keys stuff, this keys language. So hence we're going to have two parts, because there's just a lot going on with respect to the keys thing. That is really, I think, for this audience, especially in light of Unseen Realm, and I'll just, you know, tip it off a little bit. It's going to be directly connected to Christ's descent to the underworld. You know, the 1 Peter 3 thing that it should be familiar for those who have read Unseen Realm, and, you know, the use of Enoch and the Watchers and all that kind of stuff. So that whole keys thing is going to be part of that. So that needs its own episode for sure. So this time, we're just going to hit the other stuff that we have not touched on before in Revelation 3. So part one is Old Testament, Revelation 3, everywhere else but that. So I'm going to start here by reading the first letter here, really the first five or six verses. You know, you've got three churches here. This is the letter to the church in Sardis that the chapter starts out with. So let's just jump in here. I'm reading ESV. To the angel of the church in Sardis write the words of him who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works. You have the reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Wake up and strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have not found your works complete in the sight of my God. Remember then what you received and heard. Keep it and repent. If you will not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what hour I will come against you. Here's verse 4, yet you have still a few names in Sardis, people who have not soiled their garments, and they will walk with me in white, for they are worthy. The one who conquers will be clothed thus in white garments, and I will never blot his name out of the book of life. I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So that's the first six verses, and really aimed again at the church in Sardis. And what I want to focus on for our purposes, again, if you're just, you know, a listener jumping in here to the series, we're focused on the use of the Old Testament in the book of Revelation. So we're not doing a verse-by-verse commentary on Revelation. We're not talking about end time systems or anything like that. You know, if some of that becomes relevant because of the use of the Old Testament, you know, we'll hit that when we come to it. But our focus is on the impact of the Old Testament in this book. So in verses 4 and 5, we get a couple of phrases here that have, you know, hooks back into the Old Testament. They will walk with me in white, and then this reference to white garments. And you also get a reference to white garments later in chapter 3 in verse 3:18, or chapter 3, verse 18. Now, white, you know, if you actually, you know, did a search, you know, in the book of Revelation, white shows up a lot. It's a prominent color in the book of Revelation. There are, in the New Testament, there are 26 occurrences of this term, leukos in Greek, white. 16 of them are in the book of Revelation, so well over half. 8 of the 16 refer to clothing, and the other 8 of those 16 refer to some aspect of the heavenly realm, in the book of Revelation. So the connection, you know, most scholars think here is Daniel 11:35 or Daniel 12:1, and maybe verse 10. I'm going to go to Daniel 12, just so you can, you know, catch the drift here. It says here, let's go back to 11:35 first, then might as well hit them all. So 11:35, we have this language here. It's talking about the holy ones, the faithful ones in Daniel 11. And it says here, some of the wise shall stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. So you have this time of the end, appointed time, connection with being made white. Okay. Then you go to chapter 12. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. So here we have a reference to this time, and we're going to talk about this time of trouble a little bit in this episode. It's connected to, you know, since there's a reference there to this time that goes back to chapter 11, verse 35, where we get being made white, and here in 12:1 you get the same people found written in the book. You know, it doesn't say book of life, but just the book. And so you can already tell, again, this is what John is drawing on. He's drawing on something in Daniel 11:35. He's combining that with Daniel 12:1, because back in Daniel, they seem to be connected anyway. You go down to Daniel 12:10. Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall act wickedly, so on and so forth. So there's this connection with being made white at some time of trouble. That is, of course, in Daniel 12, you know, the Old Testament context is very clearly the day of the Lord, you know, the end of days, that sort of thing. And so, you know, this is kind of easy for scholars to look at and figure out, initially anyway, what Daniel is angling for, what he's drawing on. So white, at the least, denotes membership or belongingness for those who overcome, okay, at the end of days, in this time of trouble. And white, of course, would also be associated with the heavenly realm in the book of Revelation. Now, you know, that's not really news, you know, but we often fail to think about what that combination of things means, sort of where it goes, you know, where it leads, because we fail to connect it with other terms that describe the appearance or transformation of believers. Okay, elsewhere. And so Beal, for instance, in his book on John's use of the Old Testament in Revelation, he's going to do this. He's going to say, well, this is kind of interesting. You know, we've got white, we've got being made white, we've got a reference to white clothing. Again, we're drawing on Daniel, so it's some sort of, you know, end of days, day of the Lord kind of thing. But he doesn't just let it drop there, which a lot of commentators do. He asks the question, well, okay, believers transformed into whiteness or white garments. What else happens to believers in the book of Revelation? Okay, so here's what he writes. Christians taste the inaugurated fruits of some of the latter day promises cited in the seven letters even before they die. The inaugurated aspect of some of the promises, and again, he's talking about an already but not yet thing when he uses the word inaugurated, The inaugurated aspect of some of the promises can be discerned from an analysis of Revelation 2:7, in which we've talked about in earlier episodes, as well as from the concluding promises of each of the letters. And he says, if you compare, for instance, Revelation 2:26 and 27, to him that overcomes, I will put him over the nations. Revelation 3:21, to him that overcomes, he will sit on my throne. You know, it's this shared rulership thing. I will give to him the morning star. So these are transformative things. This is something that's going to happen to believers. And since the kingdom is already present in some way, it's an already but not yet sort of thing. And so what Beale's going to say here is this being transformed, we need to think of it in terms of those, you know, the already but not yet as well. So he says, if you go to Revelation 2:10, there we get a reference to crowns along with Revelation 3:11 and 4:4. We have white garments in Revelation 3, 4, and 5, of course. We also get it in 18, but we also get the white mention in Revelation 4, 4, and 6, 11. In fact, writes Beale, if the process of conquering for the believer is completed at one's death, then it is probable that the promises to the conquerors begin to some degree, okay, also at death. You know, he's connecting these things, in other words. Now, let's take crowns, for instance, when, you know, he's lumping all this together, being made white, white garments, crowns, you know, put over the nations, given the morning star, ruling with Jesus, you know, sitting on his throne, okay, all these things that show up in Revelation 2 and Revelation 3. Now, I don't know about you, but every time I heard in the past, you know, some sermon about, you know, crowns in heaven, it's always about winning a prize, like you win a contest or something. But if you're catching the drift here, it's really about rulership. Okay, shared rule as a member of God's ruling family body. In other words, as a member of God's council. The terminology of things like crowns and of this appearance, you basically you're transformed to look like what you are, you know, to look like one of those guys already in the heavenly realm who are, again, members of God's host, members of God's council. You know, angels always being depicted in white, and here we have believers in white, and we've got the language of the holy ones in the New Testament applied to believers. You know, there are all sorts of pieces to this that we fail to sort of put together, and where they all lead to is the transformation of the human believer to membership and a role, a participatory role in God's council. That's where all this language leads. But we tend to sort of look at little pieces of it, you know, in sermons or whatnot, and make it about either winning a contest or performance on earth or something like that. And it's just so much bigger than that. It's not that those things are nowhere in the picture. It's that that's not the picture. That's not the whole picture. It's not even the most important part of the picture. Now, Owen, in his Revelation commentary, picks up on the same strategy that, hey, let's look at how else believers are transformed in the language and combine all these things to get a fuller picture. He picks up on something that a lot of other commentators don't, at least in the resources I have. He picks up on the line, they will walk with me in white. Okay, the walking. And he says this, the language of Revelation 3:4 is very possibly influenced by Genesis 5:22 and 6:9, where it is said of both Enoch and Noah that they, quote, walked with God. Now, I would say this, you know, though Owen spots this, he, in his commentary, at least he sees it, but he merely comments about it as some sort of language that is indicative of a relationship with God. And that's certainly true of both Enoch and Noah, okay? For sure, that's part of what's going on. But in Enoch's case, there's a little bit more going on because Enoch is translated. He is taken into God's presence, you know, into the council throne room, so to speak. So there's a little bit more going on. Now, in this regard, I'm gonna recommend a book. Again, I typically recommend, you know, books, and I try not to land on resources that are really expensive. This one actually exists in paperback, so it's not bad. It's part of the Library of New Testament Studies, and the author is Laszlo, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the last name correctly, but Galluz. It's G-A-L-L-U-S-Z. And the book is entitled The Throne Motif in the Book of Revelation. Again, it's part of the Library of New Testament Studies series. And I just want you to listen to what he does with this kind of language, especially the crown and the throne room. Because, you know, newsflash to readers of Revelation, after we're done with chapter 3, after this whole you're made white, the crowns, and you know, sit with me on my throne and you inherit the nations, you know, we go into chapter 4. And what's chapter 4? Revelation 4 and 5. It's a divine council seat. Earlier in the history of this podcast, we had Dr. Bandy on, who did his dissertation on Revelation 4 and 5. We had him on for a specific episode about Revelation 4 and 5 being a divine council scene. And so we've been in this territory before. We are going to spend time on it, obviously, of our own when we get there in a couple weeks. But here's what Galluz says about that scene and in combination with some of this language here in Revelation 3 and really even back to Revelation 2. He says, the white color in this context evokes the notion of mercy, purity, equity, and judgment, the glory of God, victory, all these things, vindication with holiness and the color of heaven. Also, very often, two or more of these ideas are combined in the interpretation, you know, when in these visions that John has, and then an angel will interpret, you know, there's usually more than one thing going on. They usually get combined in the text. It seems that all these concepts, he writes, are inspired by the well-known white versus black antithesis prominent in the Bible, which conveys the interchangeable notions of vitality, life, light, holiness, and joy as contrasted to the inertia, darkness, evil and sorrow on the other side. The white garments they wear are consistently related in Revelation to people faithful to God. Similarly, golden crowns, now catch this, are never ascribed to angelic beings in the book. So a crown is an obvious reference to shared rulership, but angels don't get it. They don't get crowns. We do. Okay. You know, and you go back to Revelation 2. It's not, you know, to make it sound a little bit like the book of Hebrews-ish. It is not to the angels that he says, to him that overcomes, I will put them over the nations. Or to him that overcomes, they will sit with me on my throne. Jesus doesn't say that to angels. They don't get crowns. Yes, they're already in white, and believers made white means, you know, it's like the required form of dress now. You're part of this body, the divine council. But our status is actually higher than theirs. And again, that takes us back to Paul. Don't you know someday that you're going to judge angels? You know, it these are all pieces, again, of this larger picture, this larger idea. So back to Galluz, he says again, golden crowns are never ascribed to angelic beings in the book. John's careful choice of the term to designate the crowns of the elders also points in this direction. Instead of diadema, which we get the English word diadem, a term with limited reference to royal authority, Stephanos, okay, is used here, which is capable of expressing more concepts simultaneously, including the idea of victory. So let me just stop here again. What he's saying is, it's interesting that John chooses Stephanos over diadema. Because if it was diadema, it's only about rulership. But Stephanos, there's lots of other things looped in here that are associated with that term. One of which is victory, which makes good sense because he's talking to those who overcome, those who remain faithful, so on and so forth. So Stephanos includes royal authority, but it has some of these other aspects as well. And again, angels don't get any of these. It seems, back to Galluz, it seems that the imagery characteristic of this eminent group, white garments, golden crowns, and thrones, again, the elders are on the thrones, ties the elders to the overcomers of chapters 2 and 3, to whom these items are promised as a reward for conquering. So let me just stop here again. That's going to tip his hand that he looks at the elders as being symbolic of human believers, you know, who are assisting in the rulership of God. Well, where do we, you know, again, back to unseen realm, where do we get this, you know, Yahweh and his elders language? It's from Isaiah. Okay. You know, this language, you know, shows up in Isaiah that at the end of days, you know, Yahweh will be, you know, proved among his elders, or, you know, whatever the language is there. I mean, in other words, this council already exists, and now believers are moved into it, are grafted into it by virtue of this language. Galoo says, the book's dominant symbol of authority is the throne. However, the motif is not the sole indicator of the concept. The author of Revelation employs additional symbolism to connote rule, using images such as sword, crown, robes, keys, rod, horns, and heads. Okay, and some of those we'll get to in later chapters. But basically, what he's arguing for is that, again, if you look at not just the things here in chapter 3, one or two words, if you look at the description of the believers here, using those terms, and you look at descriptions of believers elsewhere in the book, even we haven't even gotten into the divine council scene in Revelation 4 and 5. We're still in the letters. If you even look that far, you're going to see a variety of ways to refer to the believer as co-rulers, you know, inheritors of the status of membership in the divine council. But again, we typically, again, at least my experience has been, you know, you're in church and it's some message about, you know, crowns in heaven. It's very isolated. It lacks all of this backdrop, all of this background. It's a very tunnel vision look at a term when there's so much else going on. It's actually a good illustration of what we try to do, you know, on the podcast. What I'm trying to do in Unseen Realm is that, look, you know, a lot of this is already familiar to you, this terminology, these ideas. But unless you have the structure, unless you have the matrix, you know, sort of built out for you, you can't really see the role that this term or this idea or this concept, this phrase plays, what it really means in its fuller extent, if you don't have the backdrop with you. You know, if you don't have the matrix, if you don't have the mosaic, as the metaphor I used in Unseen Realm. And this is a good illustration of it. Let's move on to something else in verse 5. I will never blot his name out of the book of life. I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. Now, I'm not going to spend too much time here because we've already done an episode on the book of life and other heavenly books. That's the podcast episode 89. But I do want to say a few things, and I'll loop some of that content in here just to, you know, to not leave it bare. You know, book of life is a phrase that occurs 6 times in Revelation. So you get it here in verse 5, Revelation 3, 5. You get it in Revelation 13, 8, 17, 8, 20, verse 12, and verse 15, and then 21, 27. It has very ancient antecedents. And we go into this in a lot of detail in episode 89, but we go all the way back to Mesopotamia where with something called the tablets. Remember, recall Mesopotamians wrote on tablets. They didn't write in books, okay? The tablets of destiny. And the fundamental ideas behind the tablets of destiny were you had the gods, in other words, the divine council, the Mesopotamian version. They make decrees. They decree destiny. They determine what's going to happen. They interact with people on that level. Some of the tablets are really focused on the divine king, okay, specifically the Assyrian version. And there's one that says, you are king because the gods want you to be king, you know, that sort of thing. That's a little different than saying that the gods, the council predestines every event in your life. You know, when it comes to the king, it's like their choice of putting you in authority. The idea is that the gods choose the king and then they prop up the king, and the king better fulfill his destiny because that's what the gods want, and the gods are keeping track of what the king does. Well, in some texts that gets expanded out to just normal people, that in Mesopotamia the gods are sort of watching. They decree destiny and they keep an eye on things. When you move into the Old Testament and the Second Temple literature, it is God who decides the fates of nations, you know, the fates of kings. So there's, you know, it's a little bit like the Mesopotamian stuff, but the concept is a lot wider. You know, and we talk about this specifically in the episode 89, where it could be recording things that happen to individuals, both good and bad. There is a sense of, again, keeping track of what people are doing and what people are doing to other people. There's this book of life that really applies again to those who's believing loyalty is with the, you know, the God of Israel as opposed to something else. So there's judgments, there's record keeping. Again, these are the motifs. And we've talked about this actually on the podcast a number of times. On in the, you know, in his commentary again, picks up on some of this. Again, I don't want to repeat episode 89 here. There's a lot to it. But there are commentators who are aware this is a very old idea, and it is connected to, you know, God's bureaucracy, God's council, his assembly, this whole record keeping. If you've read my angels book, I mean, the whole idea of the guardian angel, the angel who keeps watch, okay, is part of this you know, complex of ideas. But, you know, Owen writes this in his commentary about this language at this particular point. He says, the motif of a book of life in which the names of the saved are written and the motif of the erasure, the erasing of a person's name from such a book, are extremely widespread in the Old Testament and early Judaism, sometimes used together and sometimes separately. The possibility of having one's name erased from the book of life suggests that fidelity to God, rather than any type of predestinarian system, is the reason for having one's name inscribed in the book of life in the first place. I'm going to read that over again. Because again, we tend to read these things as though, well, you know, like God wrote all those names in there beforehand, and once they're written, you know, God can't unwrite them, he can't erase them. And, you know, in other words, it's this confusion with the concept of election that divorces election from believing loyalty. And I've commented before that I think election in the Old Testament is fundamentally misunderstood. Again, Israel was elect, no kidding. Duh. Okay, that's very obvious. It's just too bad that a lot, maybe even most Israelites, you're not going to see in heaven. Why? Because there's this thing called the exile. Okay, a grand apostasy of the elect. And then you have the non-elect, those who aren't Israelites, being grafted in. Well, how does that happen? If everything's written in these books beforehand, you know what? How can that change? Again, what Owen is saying is we've it's wrongheaded to think of this in predestinarian modes, because things do change. Okay, the non-elect become elect. The elect again go off and worship other gods, and they're out. Okay, things change. We have fundamentally misunderstood this idea. So Owen says, you know, this is what we got. You know, it seems, I'm going to read it again, the possibility of having one's name erased from the book of life, that's a change, suggests that fidelity to God, okay, let's just say believing loyalty, rather than any type of predestinarian system, is the reason for having one's name inscribed in the book of life in the first place. The traditional character of this pronouncement in Revelation 3:5 is evident in the close parallel to verses 5a and b in the Odes of Solomon 9:11, that's a pseudepigraphical book, where the two motifs of conquering and of having one's name inscribed in a heavenly book are combined in a positive formulation. And he quotes Charlesworth's Old Testament pseudepigrapha here in this passage, which says, "Put on the crown in the true covenant of the Lord, and all those who have conquered will be inscribed in his book." So there you have, you know, this believing loyalty idea, loyalty to Yahweh. And in Revelation's case, it's loyalty to the gospel. You don't trade the gospel for anything else. You keep believing. I mean, I know you've heard me say that 100 times now, especially if you recently listened to the series in Hebrews, but that's the point. You keep believing. That's the only issue. That's the book of life issue right there. You know, that you have aligned yourself with the gospel. You believe in the gospel for everlasting life, and you don't believe anything else. You don't throw your loyalty anywhere else to any other God or any other promises about how this or that religion or God can bring you salvation. You turn your back on all of them, and you align yourself right here to the cross event and the resurrection. Okay, this is what you do. Back to Owen. In Judaism and early Christianity, the primary setting of the Book of Life motif was the judgment scene in which God is seated upon his throne, surrounded by the heavenly courtiers, Daniel 7:9-10, Revelation 20, verses 12-15, 1 Enoch 47:3, 1 Enoch 90:20. The origin of this metaphor is certainly that of the ancient Near Eastern royal court, where records were made available to the king for dispensing justice, though the idea itself goes back to Sumerian and Akkadian literature, and again, back to the Tablets of Destiny. On adds elsewhere, the motif of having one's name erased then or blotted out from the Book of Life is a metaphor for judgment based on the notion of expulsion or disenfranchisement from the record of citizenship. Originally, however, to be blotted out of the Book of Life meant to die, Exodus 32, verses 32 and 33, Psalm 69, 27 and 28, Isaiah 4, 3, but it's bigger than that. So the point is that, again, this whole idea, election, again, this sort of predestinarian model that we often have in our heads is really not how we should be reading this. Election didn't guarantee eternal life for Israelites. Again, we have this thing called the exile. It's a really big deal in biblical history. It's fundamentally, foundationally important in biblical theology, the exile. Okay, the exile happened because there was a grand apostasy. The elect go after other gods. I mean, there are a few things more obvious in the Bible than that, if you read your Old Testament. And so he's saying, look, we need to be thinking about this. You're in the Book of Life, but you can be erased. The basis of that cannot be predestination, because if it was predestinated, we wouldn't even be talking about changes here. The basis for the language has to be believing loyalty. Again, it's very consistent. Now, that brings us to Revelation 3, 7, and 8. We're going to skip the keys stuff for part 2. So I'm going to go right to verse 9, which says this. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Now, again, we've commented on this before in prior episodes about the synagogue of Satan and what that might be and so on and so forth. I want to, you know, add a little bit, but we're not going to go back and rehearse, you know, what that is or where it is and all this sort of stuff. There's something in here that we need to add to it. And it's this last part, they will learn that I have loved you. Okay, these Jews, again, who are opposing believers, they're opposing the Messiahship of Jesus, but that's not all they're opposing. Think about it. This is a letter to one of the churches in Asia, okay, Asia Minor. Okay, there's a lot of Gentile turf here. Okay, the synagogue of Satan, if that's Pergamum, that's a Gentile city, okay? So what John is saying here, and of course he's the mouthpiece for the Lord in these letters, is that they, the Jews, will learn that I have loved you. Well, who's you? Well, it's Jews and especially including Gentiles in the family. Anyone, Jew or Gentile, whose believing loyalty is aligned to me, that's who's going to have eternal life. They, the Jews, again, are going to learn that I have loved you, and you includes Gentiles substantially, especially in these letters. Now, again, I'm bringing that up for a specific reason. Let me just go to Beale and Carson, their commentary, and they take us back to the Old Testament for some of this stuff. And again, it's going to sound a little bit familiar, but I want to make a very specific point here. Beale and Carson, in their Old Testament, in the New Testament commentary, write, the clause, I will make them, okay, in order that or so that they will come and bow down before your feet, okay, that's in Revelation 3:9, is a collective allusion to Isaiah 45:14, 49:23, 60:14, and Psalm 86:9. Now, I'm going to look up a few of these. So Isaiah 45:14. Thus says the Lord, the wealth of Egypt, the merchandise of Cush and the Sabaeans, the men of stature shall come over to you and be yours. They shall follow you. They shall come over in chains and bow down to you. They will plead with you saying, surely God is in you. There's no other, no God besides him. So it's a reference to Gentile people from the nations, admitting that, you know, Yahweh is the true God. So Isaiah 49, let's see, what was the verse? 49:23. Kings shall be your foster fathers, their queens, your nursing mothers. With their faces to the ground, they shall bow down to you. Again, it's a reference to Zion and to Israel. And they will lick the dust of your feet. And you will know that I am the Lord. Those who wait for me shall not be put to shame. So we've got a series of verses here. I'm not going to look them all up, but The series of verses is about Gentile conversion or Gentile acknowledgement of who the true God is. So Beal and Carson write this. These Old Testament texts predict that the unbelieving Gentiles would come down and bow down at Israel's feet and to Israel's God in the last days. This prophecy has been fulfilled in an apparent ironic fashion in the Gentile church, which has become true Israel by virtue of its faith in Christ. In contrast, here's the irony, the ethnic Israelites in Philadelphia fulfill the role of the Gentiles. They're the opposition. They continue, likewise, the prophecy that God would demonstrate his love for persecuted Israel before the nations seems to be fulfilled in an ironic manner. Quote, they will know that I have loved you, in Revelation 3:9b, is applied to the Gentile-dominated church instead of ethnic Israel. As apparently in, and then he gives a grocery list of passages, Isaiah 43:4. Let's just go to that one. Isaiah 43:4. Let's go back up. Verse 1 is, now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. So he's talking to Israel. Because, here's verse 4, because you are precious in my eyes and honored, and I love you, I give men in return for you, peoples in exchange for your life. And God disinherits the nations, but Israel is his own family. Fear not, for I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east. From the west, I will gather you. I will say to the north, give up to the south, do not withholding. And you get into this regathering language, so on and so forth, you know, from the nations. So it's this reversal theme. You know, we've seen this a lot, the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, all this sort of stuff. And what Beal and Carson are trying to say here is that, you know, this language in Revelation 3:9 that pits the Jews, ironically enough, as the opposer to the followers of Yahweh. I mean, Yahweh is the Jewish guy. You know, what? How does this work? Well, it works this way because a lot of the Jews, either in the Old Testament time, they abandoned the worship of Yahweh and worship other gods. In the New Testament time, they have rejected Yahweh's Messiah. Okay, who was Yahweh incarnate? They've rejected Jesus, and so now they are set in the opposition role, and the people of God become instead Gentiles. You know, it's a lot of Gentiles. If this sounds like Romans 11, then you kind of know what I'm angling for here. We've talked about this before in earlier episodes. You know, we've spent a good bit of time on, you know, the whole notion about Israel being rejected and the Gentiles grafted in, Romans 11, so on and so forth. This is essentially Revelation 3:9 is following that same trajectory. It's about this reversal, this ironic situation where the Old Testament people of God are now the opposers. They're opposing Yahweh's plan. They're opposing their own God's plan because it included Gentiles. And they're persecuting believers. They're persecuting these believers. And they're just on the wrong side. They're on the wrong side. Now, you know, in the previous, you know, episode or two here in Revelation, I've made the comment that it's incoherent to take this language as some sort of, you know, generally anti-Semitic posture. And it is incoherent. Now, you know, I realize a Jew today who rejects Jesus could read it that way, that, oh, you know, John's just targeting Jews. He doesn't like Jews. You know, the New Testament's an anti-Semitic book. But to do that, you'd have to forget or ignore a couple of things. First, you'd have to ignore that the writer is a Jew. You know, second, you'd have to ignore the fact that the comments are aimed at a subset of Jews, those who are persecuting Christians. Not every Jewish person's doing that. You know, the immediate context is persecution. Third, and we really haven't mentioned this before, you'd also have to ignore how in New Testament theology, the Jewish opposition, the Jewish antipathy, okay, toward the people of God, toward the followers of Jesus, who's the Jewish Messiah, but the Jewish opposition to that is something that God did in part to be a catalyst toward the salvation of Israel. In other words, ultimately, it's something God's going to use to turn Israel back to himself. And that's Romans 11. Okay, so Romans 11 is not talking about salvation based on original ethnicity. Like, oh, if you're ethnically a Jew, you know, okay, God sets you aside, but don't worry, you're still going to be in because you're an ethnic Jew. That has nothing to do with it. It ultimately has to do with believing loyalty. And it's a very consistent theology. I want you to listen to Romans 11 again in light of this. I'm going to read verses 17 through 23. And verse 23 is going to have something in it that really clarifies what's going on in Romans 11. And just generally, it's going to fit in with all this conversation we've had in many episodes about believing loyalty. So Romans 11, 17, Paul says, "But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others." So some of the branches broken off. Again, this Jewish, the original plant has branches broken off. Jews will reject the Messiah. And now you Gentiles get grafted in. "You, a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree. Do not be arrogant toward the branches." Okay, you newcomers, you Gentiles, don't be arrogant at the ones who were broken off, the Jews. "If you are, remember, it is not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. Then you will say, 'Branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in.'" That's true. Verse 20, Paul says that's true. "They were broken off because of their unbelief." Ah, catch that. They were broken off because of their unbelief. "But you stand fast through works?" No, through faith. "So do not become proud, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, the original branches, neither will he spare you." In other words, they didn't get in by ethnicity. You ain't getting in by ethnicity either. You must believe. Verse 22, "Note then the kindness and severity of God. Severity toward those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness, grace, the chesed. We did a whole episode on loving kindness, the loving loyalty, allegiant loyalty. Okay, it works both directions, God to us to God. "Otherwise," Paul says, "you too will be cut off." Okay, as we have fundamentally misunderstood Old Testament election, yes, I believe we have fundamentally carried that misunderstanding into the New Testament era as well. Okay, again, I just think election is fundamentally misunderstood across the board. We think that again, I'm just doing traditions at random here. I got baptized in the church, I got sprinkled, I got this, I got that. I was made a member of the covenant community. This is a sign and a seal of the covenant. Well, yeah, it is. But hey, you don't have eternal life because of signs and seals. You have eternal life. And those are just markers. Those are things that put you into a community where you can hear the gospel. But guess what? Newsflash, pro tip, you have to believe it and you got to keep believing it. You can't just pray a prayer or go through a confirmation and say, "Well, I can now, I'm past that benchmark. Now I can do whatever I want. I can believe whatever I want. I can believe in no God at all. Like, I'm in, I'm good. I can just think and believe and do what I want." Wrong. It's just wrong. And it's not that you're meriting salvation. This is not works salvation. It is a continued faith. It is a continued belief. It is a continued believing loyalty in the one thing that will give you everlasting life. And it ain't you. It ain't your works. It's the work of Christ on the cross. You have to remain loyal to that. Now, in the last verse, I didn't get to verse 23 yet. I'm going to go back to verse 22. "Note then the kindness and severity of God, severity toward those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off." And here's verse 23. "And even they, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again." So the elect become non-elect and can become elect again. I'm hoping you see how the way Christianity has traditionally thought about election just really doesn't work with this kind of language. Okay, if you're like a high Calvinistic system, I don't know what you're doing with this. The elect become non-elect, and then they become elect again if they don't continue in their unbelief. huh? It makes really good sense if election doesn't mean salvation, if it means something else, if it means access to the truth. You know, the Israel alone had access to the truth. They had a relationship with the true God. God comes to them. He comes to Abraham. He creates them out of, you know, out of Abraham and Sarah. He starts over after he disinherits humanity at Babel. So they're new. And this is all, these are all acts of God. God continues coming to them, making covenants, making promises, you know, bailing them out, you know, from this and that and, you know, crisis and whatnot, brings them to the land, gives them the, you know, the temple, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then they just go off and worship other gods anyway. Election was access to the truth. That's what it is. Okay, it is a beginning point. It is an introduction. It is a revelation toward what you must believe to have eternal life. And by believe, it doesn't mean that you pray a prayer, you pray an incantation. Okay, you know, the biblical theology is not like, you know, about like shamanistic practice. I went through a ritual and now I'm, you know, have eternal life. No. The only thing that matters is, do you believe the gospel right now? This is why the book of Hebrews, this is why the book of Revelation, this is where we're at, book of Revelation. It's this, keep believing, continue, to him that overcomes, you know, to him that endures to the end. But it doesn't mean like doing spiritual push-ups, okay? You know, it works. It's not earned. It's not merited. It's that, are you refusing to switch loyalties? Don't switch loyalties. Believe the gospel and keep believing it. If you believe the gospel, you are going to be secure forever. You're going to have everlasting life. But we have confused this kind of, you know, again, what is said about, you know, election just doesn't jive with this kind of language in Romans 11. And it doesn't jive with going back to Revelation, because, you know, Revelation 3:9, again, where we're at in this little segment, you know, he dips back into the Old Testament to remind them, look, okay, you got your opponents, these Jewish people, you know, they hate us because we follow Jesus, they reject the Messiah. But they're going to learn. They're going to learn because their Old Testament actually told them this, that the outsiders are going to become insiders. Okay, there's all these passages where the Gentiles acknowledge who the true God is and come to worship him. That's what's happening here. In real time, when John's writing these letters, Gentiles are coming to the faith. We have these churches in Asia Minor, and they are the people of God. They are, you know, a new Israel, okay, reborn, okay, but they're Gentiles. And John, just like Paul, was saying, you should have expected this. The Jews should have expected this and not opposed it, but here we are. You know, they're opposing it, and they're going to learn. They're going to learn what they should have learned already, because John's drawing his, you know, intellectually from these different passages. So again, I just wanted to rabbit trail on that a little bit. Revelation 3:10, let's just go there. It says this, because you have kept my word about patient endurance. There we go again. Patient endurance. Keep believing, okay? Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. Now that is not a reference to, that's not saying, hey, if you keep believing, nothing bad is ever going to happen to you. It's a reference to the ultimate day of the Lord, to the ultimate judgment. You're not going to be part of that. You're not going to be part of that. If you're in the family of God, you're not going to be part of that. That's his point. It's probably an allusion again to Daniel 12:1. And I'm not going to, you know, spend too much time on that. We've hit Daniel 12:1 a little bit before, but just again to read that to you. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people. There shall be a time, here's the point, there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time, your people will be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. Again, if you're in the book of life, you know, Daniel doesn't use that term, but John does. If you're in the book of life, you're not going to be, you know, at this ultimate judgment. You're not going to suffer that. That's his point in Revelation 3:10. Revelation 3:12, there's a couple of things to hit here. It says this, the one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. We talked about Revelation 3:12 last week in relation to hidden manna, the white stone, the name inscribed on the stone. That was the last episode. But here we got another one of these. There's just a few other things to say here. Again, we're just supplementing a little bit. Last time we had to dip into Revelation 3, and we're here in Revelation 3, so we can add a few things. Now, we talked in relation to the manna, the stone, the name inscribed. We talked about, well, that's really name theology. Okay, it was Old Testament name theology applied to the believer. And I'm going to add a little bit to that here from Beale's book on the Old Testament and Revelation. This is not his Revelation commentary. This is a different book. He writes here, the concluding mention in Revelation 2:17 of the new name having been written on a stone is an example of a brief allusion conveying substantial prophetic overtones from the Old Testament. Revelation 3:12 reveals that the name in 2:17 is a pregnant reference to the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God and my, that is Christ's, new name, which was written on the believer. Now, that much we hit last time. You know, if you remember back in Revelation 2, we hit these phrases about the hidden manna, the white stone with the name on it. Beale and others took us to Revelation 3:12, and somehow Revelation 3:12 essentially answers the question. You know, and he says right here again, Revelation 3:12 reveals that this name inscribed back in chapter 2 is the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, and of course, you know, Christ's new name. The name there is not, back in chapter 2, was not a reference to the believer's name being inscribed. It was rather these other things. Okay? So to continue here with what Beale says, he says, separate meanings are not to be assigned to each of these names. If you notice in Revelation 3 there, there's a list. Name of my God, name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes out of heaven, from my God and Christ's, you know, my Christ's new name. So he's saying that those aren't like three different things. They're not, you know, they don't have separate meanings. But he writes, they all refer to the intimate eschatological presence of God and Christ with his people, as expressed most clearly later in Revelation 22, 3 and 4, which reads, the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, in the new Jerusalem. And his bondservant shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. So he's saying all of these things really refer to the same thing. Now, all of that leads Beale to a conclusion. He writes this. This conclusion is also pointed to by observing that the new name of Revelation 2:17 is an allusion to the prophecy of Isaiah 62:2 and 65:15 about Israel's new standing in the future. The saints of Israel are referred to figuratively as Jerusalem, which, quote, will be called by a new name, unquote. Again, they're not different personal names. It's the name of God. There, the new name designates Israel's future kingly status. That's Isaiah 62:3. It's a direct allusion there. It also refers to restoration of Yahweh's covenantal presence. That's Isaiah 62:4. That is the same significance for the name in Isaiah 56 and 65. The promised blessings of this prophecy will be fulfilled among those in the church, the latter-day Israel, who do not compromise. Isaiah's prophecy of Israel's restoration to God's latter-day presence lies as the substratum also for all the other references in the book to the believer's name and to God's or Christ's name. Now, essentially what Beale's arguing for is that, look, all this name stuff, the inscribed name, you get a host of names. Again, there's like three or four of these. He's saying, look, they all point to the same thing. This naming points to God being present, God's ownership over the believer, but corporately, those believers that get the new name, get the hidden manna, the white stone, you know, the white garments, you know, the stuff we've been talking about today, collectively, that is the new Israel. And if you think of the church as this new form of Israel, when you go back to these passages in Isaiah 62, Isaiah 65, he loops in Isaiah 56 here, all of these things that you see in the book of Revelation about getting a new name and having the presence of God with that new name. In the Old Testament, there are references to, you know, the end of days newly redeemed brought back Israel. In Revelation, they're said of these churches, which are predominantly Gentile. So again, what Beale's arguing for is that we need to remember when John dips into the Old Testament here for this language, if you go back to the Old Testament, it's only about this ethnic entity, you know, Israel, you know, this boots on the ground geographic entity, Israel. But when John is writing, John knows that the ultimate outcome of those things is not just a single nation, again, the size of New Jersey. That's my little, you know, throw in here. John's not thinking about New Jersey. There wasn't a New Jersey. But John's not thinking about isolated geography. John is thinking about these churches that are scattered in Asia Minor that are predominantly Gentile. And he says, look, I can say this about you, these churches, okay? I can say this about you, Gentiles, because you are a new Israel. You are the outcome of these things. And all Israel really is the family of God, the people of God. And it's not tied to any of, you know, any ethnicity or anything like this. It's tied completely, again, to where your loyalty is, you know, who's your God, so on and so forth. So there's actually a lot of consistency across the Testaments, but, you know, you have this strong Gentile element in the New Testament. But John's argument, as he's dipping back into these Old Testament references, and especially back in verse 9, where we took our little rabbit trail from Romans, you know, 3:9 or Revelation 3:9 into Romans 11 about the Gentiles bowing down before your feet and so on and so forth. John's saying, look, you know, you Jews that are really upset by this, you should have known. Again, because he's drawing on these passages that talk about Gentiles coming into the family of God, acknowledging who the true God is, you know, bowing down to Yahweh. All this stuff's in your Bible. All this stuff is in your Hebrew Bible. You know, you Jews that are opposing, you know, the believers here in these churches. You should have known, and not only should you have known, but you should have submitted to it. You should have embraced it and accepted it. It should be your theology, but it isn't. And that puts you in opposition to your own God, you know. And again, that's where the Romans 11 thing, you know, really comes in here. You know, that you can be set aside, and you have been set aside, but you can also be grafted back in. You know, so he's not. This isn't generally anti-Semitic stuff. You know, it's very pointed. It's very theological, and it's very consistent with with reading their Old Testament and just submitting to it, just saying, okay, this is how it played out. But that's what their opponents are not doing. They refuse to do it. And so you get a lot of this Old Testament imagery that in its original, you know, context, of course, applied only to ethnic Israel. But here, as John repurposes it, it's just a wider picture. Now we have the Gentile reality that these Old Testament passages talked about. So I feel quite free. You know, John would say, I feel quite free to take these passages and use them to talk about Gentiles in the church. That is completely appropriate. That's how that language in the Old Testament played out. We're here in real time. This is how it played out. And if you don't like that, then you're in the really awkward position of being a Jew opposing your own God, which isn't a good place to be. So again, I think the takeaway for us with all this, I mean, we're sort of, you know, most of us are Gentiles listening to this anyway, and we're used to this kind of thinking. I think that's a good reminder. I think it's also a good reminder if we take, you know, this whole Jew-Gentile thing back to Romans 11, and we can see how the way we're used to thinking about election just doesn't work, because the ones who are grafted in can be taken out. The ones who are taken out can be put back in. I don't know how that squares with a predestinarian model. I really don't. You know, God predestinated where it ends. Okay, well, that's looking at the end. You know, in the beginning, you know, if something is predestinated, elect or non-elect, predestination language typically doesn't allow for changes in status. And that's what you have here. You have changes, and you actually have more than one change in some texts. It can go back and forth. So I think we needed a little bit of an adjustment there. and we need to get our theology sort of more in line with the text. So that's one takeaway. And the other one is, I think, you know, for, especially for this audience, when what John's doing in Revelation 3 and also what he did in Revelation 2, a little, you know, when he actually gets into the actual letters here, these two chapters, Revelation 2 and 3, in some sense, it prepares us for chapters 4 and 5, the divine council scene, because all this language that he uses of the believers transformed, again, the white garments, you know, the white this, white that, all these transformations, the shared rulership, you know, the fact that we have crowns and angels don't, you know, this sort of thing, it sets us up, again, for this notion. Again, it's just part of this bigger picture that believers can become part of this body, part of the divine council on our glorification. And this is what Revelation is angling for. And again, we're not even at the scene yet. We're not even at the divine council scene, but John is prepping that. So even in these letters to churches, he's seeding that information, you know, into these letters. And, you know, ultimately it's supposed to be an encouragement to believers. This is your destiny. You know, this is really difficult now, but this is ultimately your destiny. And I think, you know, for us, it's just it's a great reminder. It's a good takeaway, again, that we ultimately, you know, where we're headed is shared membership, joint rule with Jesus. Again, to loop in Hebrews, our brother, you know, in the council, Hebrews chapter 2. And we are participants in that council, in that assembly with him at the end of days.
All right, Mike, can you give us a quick preview of what we can expect in part 2?
Yeah, part 2, again, like I said at the beginning here, these references to the keys of death and Hades and the key, you know, keys of David here in Revelation 3, this is actually going to connect to, again, Christ's descent into the underworld. Again, there's that infamous passage in 1 Peter 3 that you know, we talk about an unseen realm a lot. And, you know, there's lots of sessions on YouTube, you know, of me talking about that passage. It's going to loop into that. It's preaching to the spirits in prison. You have to ask yourself, you know, keys of death and Hades. Okay. When would, if those are locked, okay, let's just use the metaphor. If those are locked and somehow after the resurrection, they are unlocked and Jesus has the keys to them. Logically, the only, you know, place, the only time, the only opportunity he would have had to unlock those things is when he descended into, you know, as the Apostles' Creed says, descended into hell. It's really a reference to the underworld. So when you do that, again, you're there at the abyss. You're there with the scene with the watchers. You know, there's going to be some overlap between 1 Peter 3 and this language, and it's ultimately going to have to do not only with just overcoming death and so on and so forth like that, but the reference to David is also going to be about kingship. So I think that's enough to say at this point to say this, that you have sort of a throwaway reference to keys that just sounds kind of weird, that doesn't seem like it really has any meaning or any importance at all, but it actually links back to a number of things that this audience really likes to talk about and really likes to think about. In terms of the supernatural worldview. So it's one of those, if it's weird, it must be important. And this, you know, this will be another one you can file in that box.
My favorite episodes. Really looking forward to that, Mike. I like that. All right.
Well, you like the weird stuff.
I like the weird stuff, just like our audience. You kidding me? Love it.
There's two ways we could take that tree.
Hey. All right, Mike, that's true. Well, with that, we'll be looking forward to part 2 and next week. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.